So this morning, we come to the fourth reminder of these great verses. Cultivating the desire for enlightenment. Realizing that the whole of cyclic existence to be unsatisfactory, I shall practice Dharma in order to transcend it altogether. In all my subsequent lives, may I never be separated from the ways of Dharma, and may I obtain liberation through this path. So when we reflect on or contemplate all the aspects of our precious human birth, that is when we look at impermanence, illness, aging, and death. When we review and come to understand more deeply karma in action, or the two types of conditionality at work in our lives, the cyclic and the spiral, then we wake up to samsara and we stop being fooled by it. I was thinking that actually the four reminders are like, well, isn't it amazing to be human? Isn't it amazing? I'm here. And then, oh, sugar. It's not going to last. And then, what do I do? And then we come to this reminder. So we can, if we choose to, give up trying to outwit samsara or trying to bargain with it. We can recognize samsara, rise above it, if you like that terminology, or understand it more deeply and emerge from it, which doesn't mean we're off in some heavenly plane. Samsara is where enlightenment will come into being. Samsara and nirvana are not two. Where else, how else can it show in the universe? Samsara isn't a place, it's an attitude, it's a view. I'm real and everything is here for me. It's like Miss Piggy. It's all about moi. And what creates samsara? What creates samsara is that we keep trying to get pleasure and satisfaction by engaging in unskillful activity. Activity that comes from our bewilderment, our confusion, our fixation, our desire, aggression, our jealousy, our pride. That's the Buddha's ethics, pure and simple. And it leads to suffering, not pleasure. Perhaps it's a hard truth, but suffering is the karma of unskillful activity. It's the dynamic of unskillful activity. We all want to be happy. How often have we heard this? No one wants to suffer. I don't want to suffer. So the point of reflecting on karma is to see what causes and conditions come together to produce happiness. Being at Taraloka is happiness. What we bring with us and what we bring to it, that's up to us. The causes and conditions that come together to produce suffering. So when we understand this distinction, we can point ourselves, we can direct ourselves in the direction of happiness. What is it Ryokan says? Why point your cart north if you want to go south? The tools that we use to enable this direction our mindfulness, awareness, a kind and friendly heart. And these give us stability and continuity. So if I think in terms of our ordination and our ordination process, what I often want to see is continuity, that something positive, qualities that we have, can be not only expressed but sustained. So there is a stability and continuity. So at the risk of appearing facile, if we plant apples, we're always going to get apples. And if we plant plums, we're also always going to get plums. We're not going to get pears. Oh, it's a bit obscure, but I know what I mean. So this is from Ajahn Sumedho. Trees can teach us about the Dharma. Indeed, they can teach us Dharma. A tree is born due to cause, and it grows following the course of its own nature until it buds, flowers, and fruits. The apple blossom on our apple trees this year was completely gorgeous. And then the fruits which came were quite small because of the drought. Right here, the tree is teaching us. But do we understand this? We're unable to bring it within and contemplate. We will not know the tree is teaching us unless we investigate. That's the second of the Bodhi Pakshas, the wings of enlightenment, the factors of enlightenment of which Singha Sri spoke yesterday. Sweet, sour or bitter is the nature of the fruit. And this is Dharma, the nature of the fruit. Then the leaves grow old. They brown, wither and fall from the tree. All we see is that the leaves have fallen. We don't know that that nature is teaching us. Later on, the new leaves sprout. There is nothing in this world like the greening in spring of new life. There is nothing. I think I might have added that. Yet, we merely see that without taking it further. This is not the truth that is known through internal reflection. If we can bring all this inward and investigate it, we will see that the birth of a tree and our own birth are no different. This body of ours is born and exists dependent upon conditions, on the elements, just like us. Every part of the body changes according to its nature. It is no different from the tree. If we know the things of nature, then we will know ourselves. So, it's a good sign when we start to get a bit exasperated with how fixated and fixed we are. Are you exasperated yet? When we see just how strong-willed and tenacious we are, or have been, about what is just our own version of reality. We create a bit of space and a little light or lightness enters into our experience, especially meditative experience. Just a little bit of objectivity. It only takes a little bit of objectivity where we stop over-identifying with our states of mind and believe them to be real. I'm sure you know what I'm talking about because you wouldn't be here otherwise. Furthermore, it becomes clear that it's this obsession or fixation that has caused us pain and suffering. The more self-involved we are, the more anger, jealousy, pride, and other traumatic emotions we have. If we're using strong negative emotions to get what we want, it's never going to work. In every instance, the suffering we feel results from some kind of selfish intent. It's not really bad or wrong, it's just foolish. And I love the Dharma for this, the evil that I have heaped up through my ignorance and foolishness. We come to see that we have acted in this way because we took our emotions, concepts, and thoughts to be real. A feeling plus a story equals a view. So, yesterday Sinashri said, the breath is an ally. So how can we turn our mind into an ally? So we do this through hearing and contemplating and meditating on the teachings of the Buddha. The three levels of wisdom. We do this through Dharmakata, which is very important in the Pali scriptures. It's called talking on Dharma. Good friends, Magiya. So talk about the Dharma with your friends. It's really good. So study increases our capacity to recognize what's going on round about us and within us. So I have a question for you. Do I give the Dharma teachings the attention that I could? Am I taking them into my mind and heart so that I'm no longer skimming the surface, but I'm plumbing the depths? It's said that meditation and Dharma meet like rock meeting bone.
Say the question again, please.
Do I give the Dharma teachings the attention that I could? Am I taking them into my mind and heart? So generally, we kind of pad our experience. You know, we pad it with material comfort. And it lulls us into it like a lullaby. It lulls us into a sort of trance or sleep. And the four reminders lead us from the things that preoccupy us. So why do we keep forgetting them? You know, why do we see them as defects? You know, this reminder talks is about the defects of samsara, because really they're facts, they're not defects, and we're not defective. You know, it's again what everyone who's spoken on the four reminders this week has said this. It's we lack emotional equivalence to our intellectual understanding. Or we just settle for dukkha. Mm. We settle for dukkha. You know, and it's settling for dukkha kind of means that rather than the four reminders, that we replace them with what I would call our identity project. Mm-hmm. So try and distinguish fact from value judgment. You know, as you go about panchising. It's a new verb. Turn into the experience and you get to see what's going on rather than what you think or you expect. The quality of the attention that we give will affect the object. This is also an artistic, it works on all levels. So make that step into becoming self-aware, more self-aware. We have sat through hours in meditation of being angry, hours of sexual fantasy or some other kind of craving. I mean, I know it, I've done it. Hours of blame and resentment. And at the end, it's all a bit like a dream. And then the bell goes and we come out of meditation. We see that this simple misunderstanding is working against our happiness and well-being and not for it. That's when we start to get a little bit exasperated. It's a good sign. So this clear insight, because that's what it is, into the dynamics of our confusion and our suffering. This is what Bhante refers to as part of the texture of reality. I think that's a brilliant, brilliant phrase, the texture of reality. So this is something you can explore. Bearing in mind that a feeling plus a story equals a view. We have to understand the nature of suffering and the origin of suffering. And this is why I think that dukkha is the first stage of the spiral path. Once we do this, we have to some extent the perspective of an enlightened being. It ain't that difficult. It ain't, it's common sense. You know, we have a window into the world. We see, like everyone, that everyone wants to be happy, just like us. We see how they suffer, just like us, formed of the same illusions and ignorance, just like us. And this is, I think, the spiritual principle behind the third stage of the Metta-Bhavana, genius. We begin, hopefully, to feel a genuine empathy with the suffering that others experience, and we want their suffering to cease, as much as we want our suffering to cease. And we understand that there is a connection between the two. Frankly, if I want to be happy, I know that I will be happy if others around me are happier. It's a very positive logic. I don't need to, you know. So just be helpful, be open. You know, that is the spirit of the order, helpfulness. And openness. And this is the birth of compassion. Compassion enlarges the heart. It means having the mind of the noble heart, a heart that's big and courageous. Courage is a part of metta. Those with that kind of heart want to do something about others' suffering. So I was reminded of a story about ancient England at the time when there were dragons abroad in the country. And dragons were, you all know what a dragon is. So these were big dragons. And they had the kind of breath you could light with a match. They breathe fire. And there was this, probably an experience, but at least an idea, that the dragon sat on a hoard of treasure. Mm. You know, and not only did they terrify villagers, but they had treasure as well. And this treasure, it was, in fact, made up of the bones of other dragons that had turned to crystal. And this is the most ancient kind of reference to Vajras, I think, in this culture, because the dragon sat on a source of power. And ordinary human beings wanted that power. But I would like to suggest that power is quite slippery and can be located in all kinds of places that we might not expect, like within our own hearts. So there was this knight. The legend is called St. George and the Dragon, but I imagine at the time he was just plain old George. And so, you know, the knights were full of nobility, and he was, well, he took it upon himself to kill dragons. And it's a very interesting story. So he does, in the end. I'm not going to talk about it in terms of that. But he does. He slays a dragon and protects, supposedly, the village. So we met Milarepa's demons last night. And well, I want to suggest, you know, that in Trungpa Rinpoche's phrase, we are warriors. Each of us has our demons. But the, as we saw last night, the answer is not to be oppositional. You know, we go into battle as tender-hearted warriors. And we have to, in a way, the spiritual warrior, we are involved in undoing the armor. We walk towards the dragon, and we don't go, "No way, I'm going back, I'm going home." No, you know, we face the dragon, we understand the dragon, and we start to undo all the chainmail, all the locks, all the armour, and this is the way to be with the dragon. And if we want to get close to the treasure, we have to get close to the dragon. And dragons aren't really ferocious. They just need to be understood. So compassion gives rise to love. Love, in this case, is the wish for others to be happy, to accomplish whatever their mind and heart desires. So, you know, perhaps the dragon just needs connection. You know? We don't need to protect ourselves, and neither does the dragon need to protect the horde. So love, in this case, is the wish for others to be happy, to accomplish whatever their mind and heart desires, whether it's material desire or their inner life. And this love and compassion is called bodhicitta, awakened heart. Desire is not bad. It's the object of desire that gets us into trouble. Desire for enlightenment, the will to enlightenment. And it's because a mind that is enlightened naturally and unconditionally cares for the welfare of others. So we can take this to mean something like, until all beings achieve Buddhahood, I will be courageous in working for the happiness of others. And what the Buddha discovered is that we all have the potential for bodhicitta, ripe for nourishment. So within the maelstrom of thoughts and emotions that keep our sense of self solid, each of us has the capacity for transcendental love and compassion. Bodhicitta is the radiant heart that is constantly and naturally, without self-consciousness, generating love and compassion for the benefit of others. You know this. It's a knowledge that you hold. It's a knowledge that the dragon holds. And that's all we want. It's a stream that connects us all, without fixation and without attachment. And it denotes a fine, tender sensibility. And like love, it has a place for sadness and poignancy too. Cultivating this quality will soften our future. Because given the right conditions, the enlightened mind will blossom like a flower. It's like the vision of the Buddha after enlightenment, when he looked out and saw humanity like a huge lake of lotuses. Some in the mud, the buds, they grow up out of the mud, out of the slime, out of the algae, out of all that rotting silt. Out comes a bud. It grows up through the water. A bud grows up through the water. How does it do that? And it's rooted deep into that mud and that silt because it responds to light. It responds to warmth and it grows up. And then this bud sits on the surface of the water. And slowly, slowly it opens into this translucent, sparkling, beautiful flower. And the whole of humanity he saw like that, in various stages of growth, development, fruition. And this lotus, this flower, bodhicitta, emerges whenever we find ourselves wishing for someone else's happiness, without wanting anything in return. So it's not transactional. And it can be expressed in little ways. Teeny weeny little ways. You know, in small moments of delight and care, where our inherent awakeness peeks out like a little jewel within our heart. It's a blessing that's always available to us. And sometimes we do, I think, feel this a vast, unconditional compassion or love. But then it fades, you know, like a shooting star. Very vibrant, but fleeting. And sometimes that's because we squash it back. As there's only room for me, my concerns, my wishes, my little identity project. But now, on this retreat, now that our minds are softer, more pliable, the natural joy of our being can expand. Do you dare? Oh, do you dare? In reflecting on the faults of samsara and cultivating bodhicitta, we're trying to mould our minds to the point where extending unconditional love and compassion is our mainstay. It's our anchor and our lodestar that we navigate by. It's our basic motivation. So there's just this slight switch. The will to enlightenment is somehow present in all life and manifests in any gesture of consideration or act of intelligent goodwill. Developing bodhicitta, like forsaking samsara, involves a fundamental change in attitude. The point is to change the object or focus of our meditation from ourselves to others. From facing inwards to facing outwards. The shift is sparked by seeing that the habit of always thinking of ourselves keeps us unhappy. But extending ourselves to others is the route to happiness. Do you believe this?
Yes.
Do you?
Yes.
If so, what to do? Ah, there's the rub. So, the bodhicitta, I'm going to talk now about a teaching of Vasubandhu. It's called the two trends. It always makes me think of Julie Walters' skit, which you can look up on YouTube, the two soups. What you do? She's got these two soups. And she's trying to carry as a waitress to a table. It's very funny. So our hands are full. We got these two trends. So they are two trends of experience. They're not two bowls of soup. But I'll stop that now. Which are generally considered to be contradictory. You know, since in everyday experience they cannot be pursued simultaneously. You know, if we're not stable, these two soups cannot be brought to the table. You know, these two bowls of soup. But pursued simultaneously, they must be. And so we can call these the trend of withdrawal from the world and the trend of involvement with the world. And the trend of withdrawal comes through reflecting on the faults or the imperfections of conditioned existence. There's all this physical pain and discomfort. You don't get what you want. You're separated from the people you like and you love. You have things to do you don't want to do. There's the whole business of earning a living, running a home, taking care of your body, not to mention looking after dependents. It all seems too much. It's really, really stressful. And all you want to do is get away from it all. Away, away, into the peace of nirvana. The second trend in our experience is involvement. It's concern for other living beings. And you reflect, well, it would be all right for me to opt out and withdraw from it all. I'd like that. But what about other people? What are they going to do? What will happen to them? There are people who have a much harder time than I do. Who can stand samsara even less than I can? How will they ever get free if I abandon them? So in the trend of withdrawal, you reflect on the sufferings and the faults of samsara only in as far as they affect you. You know, just look at the people around you that you know, all the people you meet. We're coming up to that time of year where if I go out into a shopping mall, I have to travel and be conscious in order to do this because of my location. I see people in such states of mind coming up to supposedly Yule, the winter festival. It breaks my heart. It breaks my heart. The states of mind that they're in. You can just see it. You know, I feel like I have to run the gauntlet, if you know what I mean, that phrase.
No.
Okay, so it refers once again to chivalry and knights, but they used to joust, you know, one of the things you had to do was ride a horse in full armor, with a lance, and there'd be a gauntlet at the end on a post, and you had to charge down and get the gauntlet on your lance. So I feel like that. I'm at the entrance of a shopping mall, and I have to get to that I don't know why, but I have to get to that store over there. And I have to run the gauntlet, you know. Anyway, just look around you at the people you know and all the people you meet, yeah. Perhaps one or more have lost their jobs. Another's marriage has broken up. Yet another has had a breakdown. Someone else may well recently have been bereaved. And even if you're in the shopping mall, well, you can bet your bottom dollar that will have happened to the people around you. And if you think it over, there's not a single person you know who is not suffering in some way. So what to, and if we, you know, what of looking further afield is in the last stage of the metta practice. When you reflect on this, you ask yourself, how can I possibly think of getting out of it all on my own? How can I possibly think of getting away by myself to some private nirvana? Some kind of private spiritual experience that may be extremely wonderful but is of no help to others. As Bhante says, so there is conflict. Not all conflict is bad or wrong. It's a positive conflict. And if you are big enough and rich enough in your nature to embrace the possibilities of such a conflict, and something tremendous becomes possible. So although these trends are contradictory, both of them must be developed in the course of the spiritual life. The trend of withdrawal can be said to embody the wisdom aspect, the trend of involvement, the compassion aspect of the spiritual life. And we must not allow the tension between these two trends to relax. As Bhante says, if we do this, we are lost. So this conflict, this tension, has to build and build until we can go no further. So my question is, how to remain porous to the world's complexities without suffering an overload that closes down the imagination. Singha Sri yesterday talked about, you know, a membrane. So how can we keep this membrane porous so that things come in and out without suffering, excuse me, an overload that closes down the imagination? Because it involves the imagination, you know. How can I get out of all of this? How can I think of withdrawing from all this when imaginatively I know what's going on in terms of samsara? You know, and the Buddha, Vasubandhu, saw this at a time when life was really not as complex at all as our Western 21st century life. Global life. So, I have a few suggestions. I'll just have a little sip. So, it's about becoming flexible. You know, we have to adjust, if you like, to different paces. The musical term is tempo or tempi. You know, each of us have a pace, a tempo that is quite individual. It's almost like a thumbprint that we're comfortable with. And other people around us move at a different tempo. So we have to be able to be flexible and adjust to that. There's a lot I could say about that, but I won't. And in your meditation practice, with reference to this overload and keeping the imagination clear, bright, open, expansive, see if, in a way, you can view thoughts and emerge, thoughts that emerge, and they will, they can fade, you know, if they're not pegged to any urgent or practical agenda. So this is part of the purpose of reflection, so that that isn't happening in meditation, and then there will be stability and continuity within that meditative space. Okay.
Sorry, Suchita, can you just say again what you should do in meditation? I lost the...
No, I didn't say you should do anything in meditation. it's about this objectivity, so that you recognise that thoughts are emerging and they will fade if they don't get attached or glued to any, or pegged to any urgent or practical agenda that appears in your mind.
Okay.
And that then means a meditative space will really contrast with ordinary daily life. But they won't be separate. They won't be separate, you know. And that the speed of one's mental and emotional life is set by the background noise in one's daily life, which is these days very high and very fast. One of the demons or dragons that sets in at this point can be doubt and cynicism. So this very high and fast background noise that we live with in our daily life can make meditation and reflection feel like so much wasteful daydreaming. You know, what's the point? I'm a nihilist. What's the point? Why bother? You know, forget all that airy-fairy reflection. I'm a pragmatist. But information floods in, it describes the world in really complex detail. And this, we say, is reality. Don't be fooled. So that there's the rub, as King Lear says. Aye, there's the rub. So the silence and space on retreat here allows you to develop an acute sensitivity to what is going on.
Mm.
And in worldly life, like a, you know, an office or even a right livelihood, that kind of sensitivity would make your head explode. So you shut down. You know, we're mirroring this, these trends in the spiritual life in many different contexts. And that risks then a much narrower view of ourselves, our potential, and the world. So my question is, how to remain porous to the world's complexities without suffering either or undergoing an overload that closes down the imagination.
Can you do that again?
How to remain porous to the world's complexities without undergoing an overload that closes down the imagination, the richness, that texture of reality, that care for others, that is more important than the care for ourselves. So if we build and build until we can go no further, these two trends, when it all seems so impossible, the demons are everywhere. But we have the Dharma, we have everything that we need. We have the three jewels. We are going for refuge. We are tender-hearted warriors. and then something will happen. It's a bit of a mystery. It's not possible to it's beyond the cognitive. I can't put it into words. So something happens, pops. We pop out, I don't know, explode. We break through to a level of spiritual consciousness where the duality that existed between these two terms is no longer operational. I know that Bhante has said at one point that he defined the difference between a difficulty and a problem. And he said that a difficulty is something that can be solved on its own level. A problem is something that can only be solved on a higher or a different level. There has to be a deeper change to solve a problem. So when this happens, you are simultaneously withdrawn and involved. You're out of the world and you're in it. Wisdom and compassion become non-dual. And then bodhicitta has arisen. There is no going back. There has been a turning around in the deepest sense, seat of consciousness. You know, and there has been a conversion from spiritual individualism to a life of genuine and complete selflessness. Can you imagine that? What a relief. It's like, you know, all those spirituals. I'm going to lay my burden down. You know? I'm going to cross the river. Deep river. So when bodhicitta is our highest priority, and frankly, Myrtle, why wouldn't it be? See me afterwards, if you're not convinced. Any circumstance is an opportunity for insight and compassion. Any opportunity. Insight taps into a joy that allows us to embrace suffering without being overwhelmed by it. You know, it's the strings of the lute again. Sona's lute. We don't have to buy into the pace of life that is so high and the frequency so tight that it immobilizes us and paralyzes us. And nor do the strings of our lute, of our being, be so loose and slack as just to thwack about, producing no tone. So stabilize yourselves in meditation. Act kindly and with intelligence. And remember the reminders. They're not hard to memorize. Remember the reminders. And this will help, you know, after this retreat with post-meditative and reflective integration. So that's your fuel. So I have the great privilege to live here, and working here in the gardens illuminates truths that change my life. I'm always completely in awe of the sheer will and energy to growth and fulfillment that I see in the gardens every spring. We're blessed in this country. I've lived in other countries where spring can happen in a week. The snows melt and suddenly it's 70 degrees and everything's out. But here, we have bluebells. Mm-hmm. We have snowdrops. It comes slow. And you think it's never going to come. It's never going to happen. You know, it's just like, and then it does. And it's just extraordinary. So I learn about the poignancy of life and the opportunity that transience brings. You know, the good thing about suffering is that it's impermanent. Change is possible. In a way, the first noble truth says things could be better. Something that has become illuminated through gardening here that is pertinent to me is the value of loving even that which we cannot control. I cannot control this. Life is king. And the importance of opening beyond what I have been comfortably enclosed by. Oh well.
Can't control it.
No. To conclude, love may be and is for the most part one-sided. It is the going out from oneself that is love, and not the accident of its return. It is the expedition, whether it fail or succeed. To love is to go on living radiantly through the world. To love and be loved is to be fearless of experience and rich in the power to give. Thank you.